Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Hello.
And Dave Trumbor.
Hi, everybody.
Today, we are very lucky to have a special guest. She is the founder and editor-in-chief of awardsdaily.com, the lovely and talented Sasha Stone.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're very happy to do it. We are going to be talking about the awards race because none of us wanted to talk about Playing for Keeps. And it has just sort of started to take off because the various critics associations have now started to put out their list for best film, best actor, best actress, etc. So this is sort of where the awards race begins. And so to begin with, I think there's a fair amount of people who, when they look at the awards, they're like, okay, there's the Golden Globes and then there's the Oscars and that's the end of it. And actually, it starts way back here in December when all these associations are getting award screeners, and so are the various guilds, screen actors and directors, and basically everyone has a guild. If you have a category in the Oscars, you have a guild for the most part. So, but right now, the microphone is given to critics associations. So we've seen the National Board of Review, we've seen the New York Film Critics Circle. Today we had three on top of each other. We had the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, we had the New York Online Film Critics, and the fact that there's enough online film critics just in New York, I find amusing because there's also an online film critics society for everyone. And we also had the Boston Society of Film Critics, and that was just today. We've also heard from right now, looking over what we've seen so far, it looks like Zero Dark Thirty is starting to really be the favorite among the critics, but we'll get to that in a bit. Sasha, since we have you here, I wanted to ask you a few questions, sort of to help listeners understand what it is about associations and circles. Mm-hmm. And so, to the start, what is the importance of associations and circles for critics? Why do the studios send them screeners? And just to give you a heads up, I'm a member of the Southeastern Film Critics Association. So, but I'd love to hear from your perspective, because obviously you know the entire state of how this all works. By the way, for our listeners, if you want to dominate in your Oscar pool, just go to awardsdaily.com. I kid you not, you will just beat everybody. It is an amazing resource. I've been reading the site for years.
It's true. He does not lie.
No, I never lie about anything, and that's why I am an honest person. But just break it down for us. Why do studios hand out all these screeners to idiots like me?
Well, I'm going to just quickly start at the beginning. I'm not going to get too wonky, but when I first started in 1999, there were maybe two or three critics groups that were around that we all kind of knew about. It was sort of L.A., New York, and maybe Boston, maybe Phoenix. There are a few kind of ones that have been kicking around for a while. And there weren't a lot of guild awards either. But in the last 10 years, it's just exploded, and it seemed like every year there was a new critics award, a new city would arrange, you know, would get together and make an awards body. And maybe it's to get the free screeners, maybe it's to sort of have an input in the race. I'm not really sure why it turned out that way, but it's just turned out to become an industry. And so the Southeastern Film Critics, actually the group you belong to, is one of the ones we consider to be the most important. And the most
really,
yeah.
Okay, I did not know that. Continue.
It's true. Well, there are just a few of them that I mean, it's kind of sounds snobby to say. I don't mean it.
No, sounds snobby. Now that I'm important, sounds snobby. Go right ahead.
But there are just a few of them that we kind of you know, hold as more important than others, and so you'd go in our world. It's sort of New York, L.A., Southeastern Film Critics, National Society of Film Critics, and those are the big ones. And then every other one kind of can sometimes get in there and wedge in a contender. But what they really function as is they look great on ads. Mm-hmm. They look great on a big splashy For Your Consideration ad that has all the winners' critics awards on it. And it doesn't really matter if it's National Board of Review, which is a group nobody knows anything about, or it's, you know, the newly formed online Boston Film Critics. It doesn't matter. It still looks the same on an ad. It's credibility. What's the word I'm looking for? You know, it gives a kind of sense of importance to it. It adds legitimacy to the contender. It makes it seem like, oh, wow, a lot of people really liked this performance. You know?
Now, I'm surprised you didn't list the Broadcast Film Critics Association on there, because I know a few people in there, and they're like, we get all the screeners of everything. And they also have the Critics' Choice Awards, correct? So
yeah, they're not influential, though. They are.
Really?
Well, only in as much as they are the way the Golden Globes are, in that they have people come up on stage and give speeches. So in that way, they can be influential, because you see a contender get up and give a speech, and that's sort of like an audition. You know, it's like, oh, great, I'd love to see that person win. I'll vote for them this time, you know, or I didn't like to see that person win because I had to watch that person lose, and that didn't feel good, so I'm going to vote. So in that way, I put them kind of on the same level as the Golden Globes, but the same way that we don't take the Golden Globes nominations all that seriously as being influencers, I sort of feel the same about the Critics' Choice, but because they have a TV show, that makes the studios really want to court them.
Interesting. So are there any associations or circles that you would say are more independent, or do they break a streak? Because it does seem like if one or two films start gathering momentum, they all seem to swing that way. And we are sort of seeing that right now with Zero Dark Thirty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the trend has shifted from all the critics agreeing to right now you're seeing like a trend of rebelling critics groups. Like the LA Film Critics is notorious now for being the rebelling film group that will just pick something even if it's just so that, because it's not the one that's winning all the awards, which is great, you know, because it shakes things up. But a lot of critics groups I've found over the years like to be the ones that match Oscar because they like to say, you know, we had it right.
Interesting. Now it's also interesting that you mentioned sort of the LA Film Critics Association, because I remember back in 84, they're the ones that sort of put Terry Gilliam's Brazil into the game a bit. They're the ones that, you know, and it had this whole problem about trying to get out from the studio, and there's the Universal wanted to change the cut of it, and there's a great book called The Battle of Brazil, and all this stuff is also on the special features of the Criterion Edition. But can someone like LA Film Critics, if they break that streak, do any of the other critics associations pay attention, or is there any way that that one film just starts sneaking into the awards conversation where it was never present before?
Absolutely, because the awards race is about perception. It's not about reality. It's the kind of thing that a year from now, you won't even remember the films that won anything. You'll just have no memory of it. Because it's at the time, everybody's kind of in love with these movies, in love with seeing things win. And I haven't really figured, I wish I was a psychologist, I'm not. I don't know how and why it works this way, but it just does every year. There's no denying that winning the LA Film Critics can push you really far ahead in the race. Like Amore just won Best Picture. That automatically puts it on the list of potential Best Picture nominees. A lot of people already thought it was going to go that way anyway. I didn't, but this gives it, you know, a lot more legitimacy. Now, if The Master had won, that would have been really good for The Master, because it was sort of not winning the awards everybody thought it was going to win.
Now, what's interesting about Amore, though, if that gets into the Best Picture race, isn't there, though, that wall that no foreign film or animated film can really ever breach in a Best Picture category, that there's sort of a ceiling for those movies?
Well, interestingly enough, the New York Film Critics is actually better at influencing and predicting the Oscar race than the LA, and it's always been that way since the 30s or whenever it was they formed. They just have a better track record because their taste seems to be more aligned with the Academy's for some reason, and or they're considered more more important, and therefore Academy voters follow what they say more. But I don't know what it is, but for instance, last year they picked The Artist, which of course won Best Picture, but the LA Film Critics completely shut out The Artist because it was winning everything.
I see. So it's very interesting. I mean, from my perspective, I'll say right now, last year we have sort of a CEFCA message board, and I don't know how everyone else is voting. And the other thing with CEFCA is we're all spread out. So it's not like I can sort of run into these people at screenings and sort of talk to them and sort of get a sense. I know only the people in Atlanta, and there's only a few of us who are in Atlanta and also CEFCA voters. But we have a message board, and I kind of pushed picked for Drive, I'm like, hey, you know, I do honestly believe this is the best film of the year, but maybe we should change it up because we are seeing the artist, everything. And my vote, I believe we did give it to Albert Brooks. We gave him the best supporting actor, or maybe runner up, but it ultimately went to The Descendants. And that seemed to be how that was rolling last award season. It was The Descendants and The Artist. And it kind of rolled that way till award season, and then The Artist seemed to break away with that.
Right.
But the year before, going back to sort of the New York film critics picking it, it seemed like in 2010, The Social Network picked up every single possible critic. If you were a critics organization, you said The Social Network was the best picture of the year. And then the King's Speech is like, ha ha ha, here's now to win all the awards. So how does that come together?
It is a tragedy.
It is a tragedy, and it's probably one of the breaking points for me. I mean, I did this for so many years, and we dutifully build charts every year, and we look at precedent, and we say, well, this, you know, no movie has ever won this and this and this and this and not won Best Picture. And to date, The Social Network is the only film that has won as many critics' awards as it has, picture, director, screenplay, got even the Globes. You know, usually there's a disconnect between the Globes and the critics, but it won everything. And so for me, it proved definitively, you know, after 10 years or whatever I've been doing this, that a movie could win every critics award and still not make it into the bigger consensus votes, because the PGA and the DGA, the guilds, they have like thousands and thousands of members versus the critics who just have maybe up to 100 or sometimes 200. It's a much smaller group. Making 20,000 or 200,000 people like your movie, if it's an edgy movie like The Social Network, is not easy, right? So The King's Speech was more heartwarming. It had really likable filmmakers, although I hear Tom Hooper is really an asshole in real life. But
you heard it here first, folks.
That asshole bridge.
But there, you know, David
Fincher's Oscar.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, that David Sidler was, you know, an old timer who had never won, and he was a stutterer, and, you know, Colin Firth is so likable, and the movie's so heartwarming. I mean, it was everything that an Oscar film needs to be. It's just that it hadn't won as many awards as The Social Network, and it wasn't as good a movie, you know, frankly. So, I mean, people obviously disagree, but you know, what you're hitting on is this kind of strange disconnect between generations. Like Drive is a really good example of that. And I feel it running my site because the readers of the site are younger and Oscar voters are older. So the younger crowd wants these movies that appeal to them to win and do well. And Oscar voters are never going to go for that. And when you say to people, they'll never go for that, they always say, well, of course they will. How do you know? And, you know, so Drive was pushed into the broadcast film critics and got all kinds of nominations. And of course, you know, all but shut out at the Oscars.
Right. So with the now just going backtracking a little bit, so we saw sort of how The King's Speech pulled up a lot of nominations, and we saw how that won, and we saw how The Artist won, and we've seen some other films win, and they all seem to have something in common, which is that they're backed by a little studio called the Weinstein Company, which was formerly Miramax. And that Harvey Weinstein really seems to love awards. And I have a question. Does he really, like, is it ego for him? And I'm sure there is some of it. Or is it also a legitimate business decision where it's like, I need these films to get awards in order to sell them in terms of box office?
Yeah, it's a little of both, because I was around when there was a Miramax, you know, and when Miramax burst through the Oscar scene and he was doing really great, you know, with Pulp Fiction and movies like that. And then they lost Miramax and they took a tumble, and then they came back as the Weinstein Co. and their first big win was they couldn't really get much traction in the awards race. But then The King's Speech happened and suddenly they were on top. The thing about Harvey Weinstein is that, yes, he's a shrewd – are we allowed to curse on this podcast?
You can curse all you fucking want.
Absolutely.
He's a shrewd motherfucker on one hand. But on the other hand, this is a guy who once told Martin Scorsese, I'm going to win you an Oscar, and did everything he could to win Martin Scorsese an Oscar, which, of course, he did not win that year. But,
this
you know
– for Kings of New York – or Gangs of New York.
Yeah.
Right.
I think Chicago was the winning movie that
year. Yes, it was.
Yeah, and that was also a Weinstein movie. But before the Chicago thing took hold, his goal was to actually win Scorsese an Oscar. And I think he has this kind of, you know, godlike perception of himself that he can do these things for people, that he can win Meryl Streep her Oscar finally, you know. And I know a funny story.
Finally, for the third time, he can win her that third Oscar.
Anyway, blah, blah, blah. But that's just all I'm saying is that, yeah, I think half of it is a shrewd business decision, but half of it is he really just wants to do what he considers to be important things.
Now the other thing is, what makes – is it just that he's a shrewd motherfucker, or what makes him better than – because everyone's putting out the four-year consideration ads. Everyone's trying. But what sort of makes it that he can finesse a film like – The Artist and The King's Speech? It's not just that they're likable, but there's something that the fact that they're coming out of his what makes him better at campaigning than other studios?
Well, he's got all the stars on his side. And I remember at one point during The Social Network when it was winning everything, and everybody kept saying King's Speech is still going to win because Social Network can't. And every headline was people are saying Social Network can't win Best Picture. It's too cold. It's too, you know, whatever. And suddenly I found out that you know, Arianna Huffington was hosting a party for The King's Speech, and all these stars were there, and Colin Firth was there. And you know, I realized at that time that Harvey Weinstein is doing ground-level work. He's bypassing people who don't read the Internet. I mean, he's bypassing people who read the Internet, who follow the news, and he's going right to the people who, like, are, like, 75. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to an Academy screening or not, but these are old people. I mean, really, really old. Some of them like use a cane, and you know, I remember sitting in the Academy Theater for the first time and looking around and going, wow, of course The Social Network was never going to win. Look at these people. You know, there's no way they're going
to
vote for them.
Maybe Amore has a chance then, because they'll see that movie and they're like, I too am close to death. I can relate.
Oh, God.
I think it's right. Yeah, I think it will do really well because of that. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I have a question. Back in, you know, with the No Country for Old Men and The Departed, we saw kind of like a shift towards more ballsy choices. What happened? Why did it go back to Slumdog and, you know, King's Speech? I mean, Hurt Locker was another kind of a gutsy choice that was a little different.
Especially over Avatar.
Yeah, and we saw kind of like a shift towards like maybe they're awarding good movies now after the, you know, disaster that was Crash. So
yeah.
what do you think happened? Like why is it now gone back to The King's Speech? They've always been old, but.
Well, no, you're right. You're right about Crash, because one inciting incident can really wake people up. I mean, the day after Crash 1, Kenneth Turan wrote in the LA Times a big article about how homophobic and hideous the Academy was, and they paid attention to that. And people started writing essays, and they shifted. So then they started to pay more attention to critics, you know, because they really didn't want to look as stupid as they looked. So they started picking, you know, really good movies that were winning critics awards, like No Country. Departed is sort of a different story because it was like, you know, everybody said that movie couldn't win. All my pundit friends said, no way is Departed going to win. No way. Leo dies at the end. It's never going to win. But I knew. Yeah, they did.
Spoiler. No.
Oh, God. I'm so sorry.
No, it's all right.
Everyone's seen it.
I know.
Why are you listening to this?
Oh, God. But anyway, that's just it. That you know, you can feel that a movie's going to win anyway, no matter if whatever people say about it. It's black and white. It's a, you know, it's still just got that winner vibe about it, which The Departed did. It was the best one of the five, I thought. But why did it go back? I think Harvey Weinstein has basically figured out how to sort of make them think it's sort of like how the Republicans tried to get people not to vote for Obama anymore, sort of like by saying it's okay, he tried, you know, but he didn't do a good enough job. It's sort of like that. It's like, you know, the critics, because basically those movies that won, other than The Departed, they didn't make any money. Mm-hmm. Not really good money, not like King's Speech money. And I think that the shift away from movies that, like, nobody watched the telecast when the Hurt Locker won, because nobody knew about the Hurt Locker, because nobody had seen the Hurt Locker, you know. And I think that caused a shift to them to want to reward movies that are more audience friendly. But then, of course, here comes The Artist, which is the opposite of it.
And yet I everyone I've talked to, people who are outside sort of the film business, they love, like, my parents love the Oscar, and everyone, I mean, the generation that they're aiming for with The Artist. And I think it's a delightful movie. I didn't like it as much on a second viewing, but I still think it's a fun film. It's a good movie. But, you know, you're right. If you were just to come up with and say it's a hard sell, it's sort of that, how do you turn a hard sell into a hook? And maybe that's what Weinstein was able to do with that one at the time.
They like movies that cost around $15 million that make a whole shitload of money. Like The King's Speech made $150 million versus how much it cost, which was practically nothing. And they like that. They don't like movies. The Departed was like the only winner in recent history that was made for a lot more than it took in. Even Slumdog Millionaire was a low budget. They like that paradigm because that sort of is the Hollywood that they're comfortable with. Mm-hmm. You know, more so than like Avatar was like their worst nightmare. Because it was big budget. It was performance capture. You know, it made a whole shitload of money. But that wasn't what they wanted to reward. They wanted to reward something that was more like nuts and bolts filmmaking, you know, 101 Hollywood style.
Well, credit to the Academy then, because I was really rooting against Avatar that year.
I know, right? Oh,
but actually, no, it's interesting that you mention, you know, the price range there's going to and what does the Academy prefer, because I think maybe we should start moving into sort of the state of the race. And the way I'm seeing it right now is, yeah, Zero Dark Thirty is picking up all these critics' associations, but it just seems like Les Miserables is just waiting to break through, just get, you know, open big and just sweep through. Sasha, what do you feel? What is Les Mis in terms of this awards race?
Dear me. Oh, that's a tough one. See, if I say anything, I'm going to get all the Les Mis fans mad at me. But if I want to
say... Adam and I are Les Mis fans, so you will know right off the bat. I've seen it. So, and Adam, have you watched it yet?
I haven't seen it, but I've seen plenty of mixed responses, enough to make me think that it's... I think it's going to come... I don't know. I don't know much about it, but I think it's going to come down to audience reaction. And if it's like The King's Speech where, you know, people fawn over it, it could do well, but I could see a lot of really negative reviews coming from critics.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's at the tipping point right now. I've never seen a movie with this bad of reviews win Best Picture. Like the lowest reviewed film is, I think it's still Crash. The lowest nominee was Extremely Loud, and that was at a 48.
Why is it getting such bad reviews? I honestly don't know.
No, I'm so sorry to have to say that. It's just a hard sit, Les Mis. It's one of those love it, hate it movies. It either captures you and it sweeps you up in it, or you're just like, oh my God, I can't stand another minute of this. You know,
I think it'd be like a movie that I mean, I won't go into a Les Mis review right now, but I would say it's like, it's a big movie. It has almost a very old Hollywood feel. It's that kind of Ben-Hur, almost, I mean, hell, let's go with Titanic. I mean, Titanic is a long sit. I think Les Mis is a much better movie than Titanic, but it just seems to have, it has the stars, it has, you know, it's just big production values, and it's, you know, it's something where it's like, there were these featurettes that just came out. It's like, look how awesome the costumes are, and look how awesome the sets are, and look how great the makeup is, and just look what a great job we did with these hookers. Like, every featurette revolves around how great the hookers look in Les Mis.
Yeah, I think it might come down to a youth thing, you know, a young versus old situation with that, because I think that what happens with it is that it moves... This is my critique of it and why I don't think it'll do well with the Oscars. And I think it'll get nominated because the actors will push it through, but I don't think ultimately that it even has a chance to win Best Picture.
Really? Okay.
Tom Hooper will be lucky to get nominated for director. I could turn out to be totally wrong. I'm prepared for that.
Okay.
But views have to tick upward from here. They have to go up. It has to get up to like at least 75, 80 on Metacritic to even have a chance for that. But the directing branch at the Oscars is 400 members, roughly. The DGA is a lot more than that. It's like, I think it's like 15,000 or something. It's up in that range. So you're going to have to, you know, Tom Hooper would have to beat a lot of these other directors that are pushing through. And the problem with Les Mis is that it's all filmed mostly in close-up. There's no talking. There's no breaks between the scenes where you can just kind of absorb what's happening in front of you. It's just like, on to the next thing. And the song solos are long and agonizing and melodramatic, and that makes it a really hard sell for everybody. It's a good sell for people who respond to that and who like it, but there are going to be a healthy portion of people who don't. And that's where you know, of course, with the Oscars, it's all about a consensus vote, and the most vanilla films do better in that situation.
Well, that's an excellent way to put it. I hadn't really thought about that because I'm a huge fan of Les Mis from the get-go, so I knew going in, I'm like, it's all sung. Isn't that amazing? Like, that's fantastic. And, like, the fact that it's in close-up, okay, well, it's an actor's film, all right. And, I mean, the Anne Hathaway scene is, like, I Dreamed a Dream is fucking amazing. It's all done in one shot in a close-up, and it just works.
Yeah.
So... But that's an interesting way to put it, because it's one of those things where you have to sort of get outside your own head and be like, oh, wait, people don't think as I do all the time. People believe different things and may not like the things I like.
I remember when I'm Not There came out, that movie about Bob Dylan, and I'm a complete Bob Dylan freak and have been for like 15, 20 years or something, you know, everything about him, every song. And when I'm Not There came out, it was like the best movie I had ever seen. Like,
that was an amazing movie. I, too, am a Bob Dylan fan.
Oh, good.
Yeah, no, that was like my second favorite film that year.
Oh, man, I loved it. But, you know, a lot of other people who didn't know as much, you know, were just kind of like, well, that's weird. You know, what is that about? But I think with Les Mis, if you come in with context and you come in with deeper meaning and you know the story and you know the characters, I mean, those songs are incredibly moving and touching and they stick in your head. And I could see how if I already had seen the play and I was moved by it and I went in to see the movie, I would fall in love with it all over again. But as it was, I'd never seen the play. I didn't know anything about the story. So I just went in cold. And it was, you know, it was hard for me to sit through it, honestly.
Okay, well, just to... I first off, we have kept Dave silent for about a solid half hour, which just makes me sad. Dave, do you have any thoughts on the Oscar?
Honestly, like I'm quiet because I really don't have a lot to sort of offer up. The Oscars and any of the awards really don't mean a lot to me. I'm more of a genre guy, so unfortunately, I'm stuck with like an MTV Movie Award or a friggin' Spike Award or something like that. That's about the extent of where my movies get rewarded. So, honestly, I'll defer to you guys, and I'll jump in when I can, but the race is never really interested in me.
Okay. Well, but you actually do bring up a good point that I wanted to ask, because, you know, we're always talking about how old the Academy members are, but they weren't always old. They weren't always old, or maybe they were, maybe they broke the rules of science and time and space. But the genre films, they keep happening. They've been happening forever. Why is it that the Academy voters just... You know, the Academy voters of yesterday just seem to not like genre movies anymore. Why do they just seem to drop those?
Right, I know. And I always come in after The Dark Knight didn't get nominated and then they changed their policy to having 10 nominees. What they did was they still basically they nominated District 9, and Avatar, of course. But they mostly kind of stuck to their same pattern of awarding critically acclaimed movies rather than critically acclaimed genre movies.
It seems like the best director field is like, okay, these are the real nominees, and everyone else is an honorable mention.
Exactly. That's exactly right. But, you know, I think it's frustrating, and after, like, I'm on my 14th year now covering this shit, and I have to say that when I hear that question, my immediate response is, why do we even care what they think? Because at this point, they're never going to open their arms and embrace.
Well, no, but that's actually the core question, and I didn't want to get to this till maybe late, because I'd love to have you back on as the awards race develops. But you bring up an excellent point, and I don't want to let it slip by. Why do we care? It is just, it feels like an objective measurement of something subjective.
Yeah.
So what is the appeal? As someone who has been doing this shit for 14 years, what do you find appealing about covering the awards race?
Well, when I started my website when I thought I would answer the question, why do some films win and others don't? Like, I was particularly stuck on Citizen Kane and How Green Was My Valley. I was really stuck on that nut of why do critics look at film history one way and the Academy look at it the different way? And why is it every time someone dies, the news anchor says, Academy Award winner so-and-so? You know, why are they so important? And I sought to answer that question by doing this shit. And in the end, I figured it out, you know, that it is everything people say it is. It is a popularity contest. It is the business of Hollywood. It is totally driven by publicists and advertising and money. And the fix is in from the get-go. And very few times do good people actually break through that pattern. And you know, people like me and Chris Tapley and Ann Thompson, we keep in the race to fight and advocate for people that we think deserve it that wouldn't ordinarily get paid attention to. And the reason for me is that it changes the power dynamic in Hollywood. Like, I'll never forget the year that Halle Berry won. Well, you know, the big discussion then was how no black woman had ever won Best Actress in, what was it? I don't remember how many years then. Now it's still only one in 85 years of Oscar history. One. And that was Halle Berry. And talking about that, it caused them to go, oh my God, we're racist. Here, black people, here, take your Oscars. And they gave
it- I would love it. I want that to be the lead up to, like, and the nominees are, and then, like, the, you know, the African-American wins, and they're like, here, black people, take your Oscar. And Forrest Whitaker is just standing there, like, has no idea what to say to that.
Well, you know, they're so horrified to be called out for stuff. And I think that if you're blogging about the Oscars, you will either tire of it or you'll go crazy if you just follow the race as it is. You know, it only is interesting if you advocate and you fight and you argue and you debate and in the end, no, it doesn't really matter what wins. It's just a trophy. But for me, it can change the pattern of what kind of films get made, what it would do for someone like Ann Dowd to win for her career, you know, or, you know, any kind of nominee to come in. What would that do for their career? How would that change the balance of power in Hollywood? That's the stuff that keeps me interested. Why are other people interested in it? I don't know. It's just, I guess it's most of my readers start at like 12 and go up to like, you know, every age. But a lot of people have been following me since they were like 12 years old.
Yep,
and they're interested.
Yeah, that's how I am.
They're interested in, I guess, the contest of it, the romance of it, that there's stars involved. And I think we all just kind of look to the year-end awards as like, this is the ultimate approval-disapproval. You know, this is the final contest that says what the best film of the year is. And we all know that it's bullshit. We all know that it's not awarding the best film of the year, that it's a game. And yet we continue to pay attention to it. It continues to hold importance in our lives. It's, but you get out of this crazy little bubble that we're in, and most people don't really care that much. You know, they don't know about it. They don't really care about it. They only care if it's like a movie they liked, like Titanic or, you know, Lord of the Rings or something like that. But
right. So with the coming back to where we are right now, we are seeing Zero Dark Thirty. What? And I thought, like, oh, and Les Mis comes in and sweeps it, and you're like, no, shut up, you're wrong. And so I'm paraphrasing. No, I know, I kid. So where do you think? What do you think that the cat – I don't see the guilds and the Oscars going for Zero Dark Thirty. Do you think they will, or do you think there's another film waiting to have it sort of – to take over
Lincoln.
The race?
Yeah, it's down to Lincoln and Zero Dark Thirty probably.
Interesting.
Les Mis – It needed the good reviews because it's all about perception. So if it got really rave reviews, it would have high enough perception to get in. It still probably wouldn't win because it's so divisive. But you know, half of the pundits, quote unquote, whatever you want to call them, people call them Oscar-esque experts, but I don't think there's such a thing as an Oscar expert. But they all are saying that they think Les Mis is still going to win. But just a few of us have Lincoln, and some people have Zero Dark Thirty. A lot of people like that I know are saying Zero Dark Thirty is not a movie that can win the Oscar because it's too cold, it's too this, it's too much of a...
It has a happy ending, kind of. Even though we know what it is.
Exactly. I think it has to have some kind of an urgency to award it that gives it the win. And I don't know that either Tom Hooper or Catherine Bigelow have that with the Academy. I think they might feel like they've already done that and that they want to go a different way.
A different way be like, hey, this Spielberg cat is an up-and-comer. Let's shed some light on his career.
This young whippersnapper. No, I mean, for him, it would be more like a career achievement because this movie's made more than almost every movie in his recent career, except like the big blockbusters. Like it's heading toward $100 million, which is really crazy money. And for him to have such good reviews, and he's he's the king of Hollywood, this guy, right? Everybody loves Steven Spielberg. So in Hollywood, and they love Sally Field, and I mean, if you just look at Lincoln's cast, it's like the entire SAG membership is in Lincoln.
In beards.
In beards and funny makeup. So, I mean, I'm feeling a lack of buzz for Lincoln right now, but I don't know what that means. I'm still, my mantra is it's Lincoln's to lose unless the DGA tells me otherwise. And that's what I'm going to look to is the DGA. It kind of reminds me of the Gladiator year, where it was Gladiator, Crouching Tiger, and Traffic, and all of these movies kind of all at once. It could be that they're just too many good movies and that everything splits up. And I mean, like Michael Haneke could win Best Director for that, you know? Could be some weird thing like that happening.
Okay. So Now, let's can we? I kind of want to look at sort of the individual race. I mean, we're looking at Best Picture, but going through the acting categories, you mentioned Sally Field, and there's some critics' organizations saying like she's Best Supporting Actress. I'm like, are you kidding me? She's the weakest part of. And I know it's. I mean, I know again, like it's a qualitative argument, and maybe that's not the best direction to go. But I am a little surprised, especially because I do think Anne Hathaway does have that amazing scene in Les Mis. I've also always seen Best Supporting Actress as the young woman's award. Like, I see Best Supporting Actor as the old man award, and then, like, Best Supporting Actress as the young woman's award. Would that be a fair assessment, just looking at how the awards have been distributed over the years to those winners?
No, because, you know, you have to work in the politics. You have to work in South Field's veteran status and how many people she knows in Hollywood, and you have to work in how much they love her and how much people like Julia Roberts love her, and you know, people who worked with her. God, Burt Reynolds. I mean, she's been what, acting for 50 years or something. Right. I mean, the truth is that Sal, I mean, this is where knowing Oscar history and it can help pick a winner. But if she's going to win, I still think Anne Hathaway is going to win, but and I think she'll be Les Mis's big, you know, win. For the major categories, but both Sally Field and Daniel Day-Lewis will be looking at winning their third Oscar, and that's a huge hurdle because yeah. Daniel Day-Lewis will be making Oscar history if he does, and I'm just not sure that they're ready to do that with him yet. And Sally Field, same thing, she'll be winning her third Oscar, and these are really hard awards to win, so that automatically puts them.
Well, she does like a Meryl Streep and is nominated like 7 more times, and then on the 8th time she can get her third Oscar. That's apparently how it has to work.
Yeah, but she's been acting so long, she's way earned her veteran status.
Oh,
but,
sure.
I mean, we just don't know. I think that her likability in the industry could give her the win in the end. Just that. Yeah. Just that.
And see, this is why I'm so glad we had you on. For many reasons, but you know the politics. And I think that's something that a lot of us on the outside, we just don't know. Like, I had no idea Sally. I mean, it makes sense that Sally Field is popular. It's not like but then again, I didn't know people hated Tom Hooper. So then, there you go. It's all about the who likes who. I mean, I have heard rumblings about that. Like, sort of the back when for Up in the Air lost to Precious because people just didn't really like Jason Reitman. And they're
I know.
Like,
God, that was a weird thing. I didn't know that until after the awards were over. And I realized it.
I hadn't heard that.
Okay, so I'm the now apparently I know the politics.
No, but like Lauren Bacall, you know, like Lauren Bacall up against Julia Binoche. Everybody thought Lauren Bacall couldn't lose because she was so well loved and she'd been acting. She was, you know, married to Humphrey Bogart, but apparently she was like considered a royal bitch who like slapped people backstage and made these horrible demands, and no one liked her. And so when she lost, people were just like, well, there you go, you know, because they vote for who they like, period. If they like the character or they like the actor, that's how you win.
I see. That's very interesting. So would you say, and also I have to point out, Adam is sort of the one covering the majority of our Oscar stuff for the site. So I kind of want to get your sense right now. Who is leading in Best Supporting Actress? Sasha, who do you say is leading in that category?
Well, if you look at the Critics Awards, you would have to say that Sally Field is, with Anne Hathaway as the runner-up. But if I had to put a number one, I would still put Anne Hathaway. So I would say she's leading only because I'm anticipating that that will be Les Mis' big award. Now, if Les Mis is completely shut out of the Oscars, obviously, other than that award, that's going to be a tougher call.
Okay. Adam, what about you? Where do you see the state of the Best Supporting Actress?
I feel the same way. I feel like Anne Hathaway could win it. If I feel like Les Mis will still be nominated for quite a few, especially in the lower categories because of its production value and everything like that. But I feel like Anne Hathaway might be its only win of the night.
There are so many like makeup and like
the
costume
the
people that
thing.
Just heard you say lower category and they're just like,
well, I mean,
listening to this are like, ah,
I should have said below the line.
Okay. Okay, so that's interesting. Now, moving on to Best Supporting Actor. And actually, I've been writing up my top 10 lists, and every year I sort of like who was my favorite supporting actor and supporting actress. And it always seems, and I mean, this is just sort of the sad state of Hollywood, that it's, in terms of like great performances, there just are so many fewer great female roles out there. Like, there's occasionally like an exceptional year. Like a couple years ago, we had, like, it was the year of The Kids Are All Right and also Animal Kingdom. And it seemed like there were more great roles for women. But usually that's the outlier, and I think this year is one of those years where there are just so many great roles for guys, and Best Supporting Actor for me was just a really crowded field, and it's going to be tough for me to cut that down to just five. So, right. Sasha, where do you think the Best Supporting Actor race is?
Well, it's tough. I don't feel like there's a leader in that category right now. I think that it's maybe going to depend on what movie wins Best Picture. Like, I think that Jason Clarke from Zero Dark Thirty, if he gets enough attention, he could get pushed into the race. Obviously, Tommy Lee Jones is already a previous Oscar winner. Great in Lincoln, plays like one of the best and most liked abolitionists characters. And he's also beloved in Hollywood.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I've only heard nightmare stories about him from like on the press circle.
Yeah, the press.
Okay, he hates the press, but among like actors he's well liked.
Oh yeah.
Okay, got it.
I read an interview with Sally Field recently where she said that I can't remember what movie they did together, but they hated each other and bickered like cats, but she was just like singing his praises from Lincoln. She said she loves him. She said he's a gruff, like that's who he is, but she loves him for him.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I forgot what movie it was, but she said they hated each other. Like, they just would not say nice things to each other. But then she said that after the fact, he called her up and apologized, and she said she thought that was really sweet.
Oh.
Okay, so
I think he's just, like, a no-bullshit guy. Like, he's not, like, I've read plenty of, like, awards interviews with him, and he's just not having it. Like, if you ask him to, like, Anthony Breznican asked him, you know, what he could learn more about his character if he could speak to him, and he said, "I can't answer that question. He's dead. Like, I have nothing to say."
That is true.
That's
fair. Tommy Lee Jones does not entertain a hypothetical, sir.
I've never seen him answer a hypothetical.
The Tommy Lee Jones and Sally Field movie might be Backroads, according. I'm just the guy who Googles stuff while everybody else talks today.
We have really shut Dave out of this conversation. I feel so bad.
No, I'm like that. I'm like the guy on PTI that just is a fact checker. I'm okay with that today.
Okay.
No, but Backroads, apparently, if you guys have heard of it, 1981.
I have not heard of that film.
Yeah, bizarre.
Okay, so Adam, what about you? Where do you see the category?
That's, I mean, I like Tommy Lee Jones, Alan Arkin, I think will definitely be nominated because he's kind of beloved in the community. But I'm with Sasha that this one's really kind of up in the air. I could see Matthew McConaughey getting in. Leonardo DiCaprio is kind of hurt by the fact that they're now pushing Christoph Waltz as supporting actor too.
Also, I think Christoph Waltz is the better, the flashier performance and
yeah.
the better
Well, the problem
performance.
Is that I don't think Django Unchained will be a big player in Best Picture or Best Director, so it's going to come down to those categories and it could split them. So that could hurt both of their
now,
chances.
Now, here's an interesting question. Sasha, why would Django not be a big player while a film like Inglourious Basterds would be?
Well, I'm not really sure what's going on there, except to say that I actually haven't seen it yet, but okay. I know that's crazy. I'm going to see it. I missed a couple of the early screenings and I couldn't quite get out to see it. Jeff Wells would kill me, but but that's just how it's turned out for me. But I would say just from my perspective right now, I think it's weird that everybody said Leo and then Leo didn't turn out to be a favorite in these early awards. It seems like another love it, hate it kind of movie. Like it seems really intense and strong flavor. And if you love it, you really love it. And if you don't, there's not going to be anything pushing the Academy to want to reward Tarantino. The other problem is, of course, that the Weinsteins have their hands full with Silver Linings and they're going to have to push that aside to really. And believe me, if they didn't have Silver Linings, you can bet that Django would be the big movie. But it's not on their – they don't want to do anything to hurt their potential Oscar winner, I think. That's my judgment. I don't know if that's true or not. It could totally be fantasy land paranoia, but that's my take on it.
I do have a take on why Inglourious Basterds did well, and I will play my Jew card to do so. No, I will say – because this is – I forget who – and I'm quoting someone, but I think it was an excellent point. And even though both films were nominated for Best Picture, it came out the same year as A Serious Man. And the point was that – A Serious Man is who Jews actually are, but Inglourious Basterds are who Jews would like themselves to be. And I think that wasn't like a bad – I mean, it's like, we got to shoot Hitler in the face. Oh, my God. That's fucking awesome. Whereas, like, A Serious Man is like, yeah, that sounds about right. The rabbis aren't very helpful, and it doesn't really matter, and, you know. But with
– How pissed do you think Tarantino's going to be when he loses to Bullock in because he recently went on Howard Stern and he admitted that he said he was fucking pissed when he lost original screenplay to Bull for Inglorious Bastards.
Wait, who did you lose to Mark Bull for
The Hurt Locker.
Wine, Tarantino. You got your best screenplay Oscar for Pulp Fiction. You can put that aside. I mean, I love the guy. I love his movies, but you, when you have that statue, you gotta, you turn it off about, oh, I don't have another statue?
Right.
Why don't, look at my mantle. They would be, it'd be so much better if I could flank all my other awards with my two Oscar awards.
I just think it's going to be funny that he has a good chance of losing to the exact same person who he lost to last time.
No, it is. It's so funny. I don't know if he'll even be in the race, though, at this point, because it
That's
feels...
That's what I was surprised by. I haven't seen him on many shortlists for original screenplay, and I kind of figured he was a lock for at least a nomination.
Right.
And it just feels like it's coming too late. Like, ballots go out on the 17th, and they have to be turned in. I just have a feeling that... It's possible that he might get on Writers Guild and then not on Oscar. I don't know. It's going to be a really strange year, you guys, because I don't know if you've, you know, if anybody else cares about this except me, except for the fact that Oscar ballots will be turned in before the Directors Guild announces their nominations and the Producers Guild announces their nominations. And that's never happened ever in Oscar history that I can think of. Usually the DGA announcement comes out and it's kind of like Oscar's true north. It's like, oh, okay, those five. All right, that's it. Those are the five best pictures right there. But they're not going to have that opportunity, so Oscar voters are going to kind of be flying blind with no guidepost except early critics' awards and, you know, whatever noises the publicists are making.
Well, that's interesting.
I know.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
So moving on to Best Actress, I think right now Jessica Chastain is the clear leader. Am I wrong that she's sort of, even if Zero Dark Thirty may not get the best picture thing from every critic, she seems to be pretty well liked as even the avatar of, and not the movie, the sort of the representative of Zero Dark Thirty, that even if you weren't going to give it to that film for best picture, you could honor it by giving it to Chastain. Is that a correct assessment? So far I've been wrong on everything. I'm like, is it this way? And Sasha's like, no, you're fucking wrong. Shut your goddamn whore mouth. And I'm like, oh, okay.
No, I'm sorry. I think Jennifer Lawrence is still in the lead only because, I think that that's exactly why she would win, is it would be a win for the movie. You know, it's always like that. It's like the stronger the – not always. Sometimes it's just the performance, but a lot of times it's the stronger the best picture contender, the better the chance it has to win in the other categories, like even screenplay and editing. And there's just talking about like the major categories. But so like if Silver Linings Playbook is not going to win anything, it's probably going to win Best Actress.
Interesting.
Unless it's like up in the air and it's completely shut out, which, by the way, it was shut out for every award up in the air. And at this time last year, the Gurus of Gold was predicting up in the air to win Best Picture, and it won nothing. So that's how weird perceptions can be and how things can change really fast.
Yeah, I was shocked by that. I remember following that year, especially when what's-his-name won for Precious over Reitman. I thought at the very least Reitman would win screenplay.
Yeah, right. Me too. I was shocked.
We should all just know he was disliked. If we had only known that he was unliked by his peers.
We only knew that everyone hated Jason Reitman.
I did not know that.
But Adam, what about you? Where do you think Actress is right now?
I don't know. Given that I've only seen Silver Linings, but I've heard so many strong things about Zero Dark, I know that Chastain is also really well liked. But I've seen so many just like blog posts and whatever from awards people talking about how likable Jennifer Lawrence is, and I feel like that can go a long way, how everyone just loves her. And I mean, we've seen it. I mean, I think you interviewed her for a junket one time, Matt, maybe.
No,
not but
me.
Okay,
but I've heard,
well,
she's, I've read interviews, she seems very likable.
Yeah, and
she's
and
good,
I think
in the film, and if the Weinstein Company, with their clout, and they have a hell of a crowd pleaser in Silver Linings. Mm-hmm. That is just an easy movie to like. It's a feel-good film. It's a weird film to come from David O. Russell, who used to make, you know, I mean, he made I Heart Huckabees, which is a film designed to make sure nobody likes it. Although I kind of enjoy it. But it's that kind of thing. It's weird how he's softened very much over his last few movies.
Right.
This seems almost like a softer film than The Fighter.
Well, I'll tell you a little story. I don't know if you've heard me say it before, but I was at a screening for Zero Dark Thirty, actually, and I was listening to these actors talking next to me, and they were just going on and on about Silver Linings, how much they loved it, how much they loved everything about it. They loved Jennifer Lawrence. They loved Jackie Weaver. They just loved the movie. And then I heard her say, I saw Les Mis, and she said, yeah, me too. And then it was like dead silence. telling you to prepare yourself for this.
I mean,
going to be that kind of situation, but the real thing is, I just thought that you would think that was funny, but the real point of that is how much women and men both, it's not just like horny old guys who like her, it's women like her and they like the part too. So, I mean, I feel like the love for her character and the love for her and that she's made Hunger Games this year, which I think made like 400 million or something. I think all that combined give her the front runner status. I could be wrong. I don't know.
Well, here's the thing. I don't mind. Like, for me, it's like whatever wins. I know I'm confident in what I like, you know.
Right.
It's, so I'm okay with being completely different from critics groups. And I mean, let me put it this way: the way SEFCA we submit our ballots is like a top 10 list, and it's weighted. So, you know, and on my top 10 list in the 10 slot was Hobo with a Shotgun. So that should just tell you everything you need to know about where my tastes are in relation to everyone else.
I think that's great. I wish that we all could learn to think like that, you know, because it doesn't really mean anything that 5,000 or 6,000 Academy voters think this is the best movie. You know, it's like liking a status update on Facebook. It really doesn't mean much more than that.
That will be the future. Like, well, no one likes, it's like, Silver Linings Playbook's got, you know, 6,000 thumbs up.
Exactly. That's
best picture.
I do love when those surprises sneak in, though, like John Hawks for Winter's Bone and Dwight Henry for Beasts of the Southern Wild L.A. today really got me thinking that I would love to see him sneak in there.
Same here. Absolutely.
Yeah, maybe he'll be this year's, you know, Demian Bakar, seeing how that
went.
And that's been huge for that guy's career, for Bakar.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's sort of – to me, that's where the Oscars are sort of at their best, when it helps make a tangible difference in the life of, you know, an actor or just anyone's career. Like, we can talk about how, oh, it doesn't really mean that this was the best picture, but it does have a legitimate, and Sasha, you were saying earlier, it can kind of help control, like, what kind of films are getting made and, you know, who gets to star in them and so forth. So I think there can be a good to this whole process. So,
yeah, for sure.
And so just to finish up with Best Actor, let's go the whole thing. We'll go Best Actor and then Best Director. Best Actor, where are we right now?
Well, again, I think that Daniel Day-Lewis, to me, is the favorite kind of heading into the race, but I also think that his winning a third Oscar is is potentially insurmountable. It's maybe going to happen, but it's one of those crazy rare things. So if it's not him, who would it be? I don't think it's going to be Joaquin Phoenix. I just have a feeling that they're not going to go for The Master that well. I was thinking for a while that Hugh Jackman could actually win because he lost a lot of weight and it's really a tour de force. It's probably the best performance he'll ever give in his life, you know?
I love The Fountain, but that's just me.
Yeah. Okay. So, right. But this is more like,
no, for a mainstream thing. And I mean, also, I mean, this is his wheelhouse through and through. I mean, he's won the Tony. He's a musical guy. So this is him.
He was the one I was thinking is the only one that could beat Daniel Day-Lewis. But now I just don't even know. I mean, I feel like it's sort of, there's like a little backlash against Daniel Day-Lewis in the movie, and so I don't know what it's going to turn out.
I'd love to see the Lincoln backlash. Like, someone sits back and, was Lincoln really that good? Was he really that great of a president? Really? Like, I would just love to see, like, Harvey Weinstein, like, plotting his, you know, because everyone plots their little counterattacks. Like,
Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. No, that was it. The Whisper campaign and Saving Private Ryan was that it was all about the first 45 minutes, and people think that that's what derailed it for Best Picture. Harvey Weinstein and his publicity team, actually, they all do this, though. It's not just them, but they like to float these, you know, little perceptions that can take down a movie. And I don't know what happened with Lincoln, but I guess people were just so sick of it winning. It wasn't really even winning anything, but maybe Daniel Day-Lewis, but all of a sudden today, the LA film critics, they were just like, oh, God, thank God Daniel Day-Lewis didn't win. Thank God Daniel Day-Lewis didn't win. It's like, God, why?
What do you think the chances are for Suraj Sharma? Anything from any buzz on him at all from Life of Pi?
Oh, only from me. He's the one that I love to see get nominated, but everybody laughed at me when I put him on my
Really? Board. Now I'm there with you.
Yeah, no, I think he carries
for
that whole movie.
Yeah.
He was great, yeah.
Okay, so, and Adam, what about you? Where do you think we are on Best Actor?
I'm just so blinded by the brilliance of Daniel Day-Lewis's performance. I don't see how anyone could not give him that award. But I hadn't thought until Sasha said today about the three-time winning. I just don't know who could beat him. I mean, I guess Joaquin Phoenix, but do people like him enough? I was baffled by Bradley Cooper winning the which film critics awarded him Best Actor?
National Board of Review.
Yeah.
Do we have a split vote? Like we had in 2002 when it seemed like Jack Nicholson and Day-Lewis split the best actor vote and Adrian Brody just kind of sidled on in there instead of this dark horse winner.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe that'll happen again. But I agree. Right now, it looks like it's Daniel Day-Lewis. But it does feel like we're at such an early stage right now.
Right.
But even though we're at that early stage, what are we doing in Best Director? Because that one just seems wide open.
It does. It really does, doesn't it? I don't know. I can't decide. I keep thinking that, you know, maybe it'll split and it'll go Catherine Bigelow Director, something else Picture, Steven Spielberg Director. And looking at history, I saw that, you know, a lot of times directors will win Best Picture, Best Director, and then the second time they win, they only win Best Director. It's really rare to win both a second time so soon. So that puts Catherine Hooper.
The horrible amalgamation of...
No. Directed that great Middle Eastern musical. No. They're at a disadvantage, and then we talked about this already, but Steven Spielberg, too. So who knows, right? Early in the race, I was thinking David O. Russell might finally be due and might get his due, but it's just not looking that way.
And then everyone will play that YouTube clip on a loop of him blowing up on the Huckabee set.
Yeah.
And that'll be that.
They'll be on the backlash train, but I still feel like I got to put Lincoln and Spielberg, just me particularly because I tend to be a little conservative in the early stages, but I would say that number one would be Steven Spielberg, number two is Catherine Bigelow.
Okay, right on. Okay, so let's talk about movies that have won awards. We're going to do our recommendations. Sasha, would you please start off for us?
Yeah, I have kind of a boring choice, but it's No Country for Old Men.
I think that is not a boring choice at all. I want to talk to you about your recommendation, but continue.
Good. I'm just going to say that it is a movie that won a lot of critics. It didn't win Los Angeles critics, but it won basically every critic award heading into the race. And the Coens had never won. They've won screenplay, but they never won director for Oscar. And it was one of those years where everybody said it couldn't win because it was too dark. It had a weird ending. And Oscar voters only like feel-good, uplifting movies, and they went for it. And so it was a great moment for me covering the Oscars, and I think it's such a worthy film. I liked There Will Be Blood, too, obviously. It was also a good movie, not as much as this one. But I feel like I watch it like 5 times a year. I know every line. And if I had to recommend any movie, that would be it for now.
Why do you think – do you think that was still part of like the crash – backlash that No Country was able to sort of sail to Best Picture on that? I mean, it was such, it's one of those films where it's the exception. You want to look at the last 10 years, it's like, oh, I didn't believe in that film and that film. And then you get to No Country, and it's like, yeah, that sounds about right. I can live with that.
Yeah. Oh, I think I interviewed an old-timer Academy guy once, and he told me, I said, well, what do you make your decisions? And he said, I just vote for the Best Picture. And I said, well, what does that mean? He's like, I don't know. It's just the Best Picture. And I said, well, what about Shakespeare in Love? And same for Shakespeare in Love was the Best Picture. That's what he said. And so that, to me, was the No Country year. It's just – your sense gets a little off when you love a movie that isn't going to like The Social Network for me. But my sense is that it was just the best, and it was obviously the best. And despite what the pundits were saying, I don't think you can second guess people when you're talking about a movie that good.
Okay.
Some people didn't like it, you know, but.
Right on. Well, it's a great one. So, but then again, I think the Coen brothers should win everything every year,
yeah.
But that's just me. Dave, because when you're done fact-checking, why don't you tell us what movie you'd like to recommend?
It's Trumbore's Time to Shine. I'm going to go back to 1941 Citizen Kane.
I'm not familiar with that film. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Not familiar with that, which was widely regarded as the best film of all time until recently Vertigo bumped it off. I was surprised to learn that it didn't actually win Best Picture. I had no idea. And Sasha informed me earlier today that there was sort of an interesting backstory to that, since we were talking a lot about the politics of the Academy and how they vote. Citizen Kane lost to How Green Was My Valley, which was directed by John Ford. And Sasha mentioned that Ford had won Best Director twice before, once for The Informer and once for Grapes of Wrath, but he happened to lose Best Picture for both of them. So the Academy decided to give it to How Green Was My Valley instead of Citizen Kane. It also complicated by the fact that Orson Welles, who was a writer, director, and star of the film, is pretty much his first time doing anything, and he was this you know 20-something upstart. They just kind of assumed that he'd be back next year or the year after that. But I just thought that was an interesting little side story for our awards talk today. So if you still haven't seen it, check out Citizen Kane, the 1941 picture that did not win Best Picture.
Okay, Adam, what about you?
I'm recommending James L. Brooks' 1987 film Broadcast News, which is one of my all-time favorites. It was nominated for 7 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, and it won 0. For some reason, Holly Hunter lost Best Actress to Cher for Moonstruck, which still baffles me, because it doesn't get much better than Holly Hunter in this movie. It opens with a brilliant opening scene showing 3 young kids who kind of embody what their characters become when they're older. Holly Hunter is a television news producer. Albert Brooks is kind of the reporter, the brainiac writer guy. And then William Hurt is the good-looking anchor who kind of isn't as smart as everyone else. But it's a really good – it's essentially a romantic comedy, but it's really kind of just – a great journalism movie, but also, you know, just relationships. This is what Judd Apatow, the movie that Judd has been trying to make for entire career. And, you know, it's almost kind of quaint, the journalistic issues they have in this movie and kind of integrity, what they see as something that could be kind of wrong or maybe controversial kind of is kind of commonplace nowadays. But I won't spoil that for you. But Broadcast News, check it out.
Okay, right on. I will finish up by recommending 2000's Traffic, which won the best film from the New York Film Critics Circle. It was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, and it won 4 of them, including Best Director for Steven Soderbergh, but lost out to Gladiator. For those who haven't seen it, it's a film about the war on drugs, but what makes it better than that, than just preaching to the choir about yes, the war on drugs isn't working, is that it's really a film that goes more to the larger human issues that everyone can relate to. So the film follows multiple plot lines. One is about this cop in Mexico, played by Benicio del Toro, who won Best Supporting Actor that year, and finding this sort of – he's embroiled in the middle of 2 competing cartels. Michael Douglas plays the new drug czar for America, and only to discover that his daughter, played by Erica Christensen, is a drug addict. And you also have Catherine Zeta-Jones as this woman whose husband is arrested for being a stateside drug kingpin, basically, and she has to sort of figure out how she's going to protect her family and her wealth. And these plot lines intersect with each other. And the larger issues it goes to is, you know, you can have it as like, oh, it's a father who, you know, he learned that his war on drugs is misguided and that it's close to home. But really, it's you can just expand it to a story about how does any parent protect their child? Or at one point, Don Cheadle plays a DEA agent. And this star witness played by Miguel Ferrer asks him, you know, you're just a pawn in this whole game. You take down one cartel, you're helping the other, and you're not making a damn bit of difference, and you do it anyway. And I think that's just, I mean, you could say that about life. You know, you go and you keep trying, and you may not make a difference, but you fight anyway. And so it's those larger themes that I think makes Traffic live on, as opposed to other films that just say, yeah, the war on drugs isn't working. It's like, well, yeah, we know, but try harder. Try to make a story and with characters. And that's what I think Traffic does incredibly well. So just to repeat, thank you so much to Sasha Stone for joining us today. It was a really informative conversation, so thank you so much for giving us some time today to talk about the state of the awards, and I hope you'll come back when we have the next phase, when sort of the guilds start chiming in.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was really fun talking to you guys.
Oh, it was great. And so next week, we will be talking about The Hobbit, because in the end, we are geeks, and that's our movie. So that's our audience, and it's The Hobbit, and has its own history. And we didn't even mention that. I don't think The Hobbit's in the awards race at all, which is kind of interesting when you consider that all 3 Lord of the Rings films were nominated for Best Picture. So
I'll be interested to see if the high frame rate affects its below-the-line chances.
It's so bad. The high frame rate is so bad.
Unless they see it regular, it's not going to forget it. They're going to go, oh, my God.
Yes.
Which is so interesting because all of that, it's the same creative team, mostly from the original trilogy, which won so many. I just think that's so interesting that high frame rate is just killing everything.
Yes, yes. What have we learned? We'll be back to talk about that next week. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you can do it on Twitter by following us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Dave?
At Dr. Claw, MD.
And Sasha, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Awards Daily.
And just to remind people, awardsdaily.com is also the website. You should definitely check it out. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.